It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency announced this week that if the state DNR doesn't submit long overdue pollution regulations, it's going to step in and impose its own.
First, should third-party candidates be included in Wisconsin's gubernatorial debates?
The state's Libertarian Party has filed a complaint to the Government Accountability Board against the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association for excluding third-party candidates from a governor's race debate.
This year, the excluded candidates are Robert Burke of the Libertarian Party and Dennis Fair of the People's Party. To be included, the WPA says candidates need to poll at least 10% and raise at least $250,000, which means only Democratic candidate Mary Burke and Republican incumbent Scott Walker qualify.
These criteria are intended to exclude non-serious candidates from potentially overcrowding in a debate, but the Libertarian Party says these limits violate state campaign laws by favoring candidates from the two big parties with free broadcast time, creating in turn a disadvantage for the other candidates.
Libertarian Party member Andy Craig filed the complaint to the GAB, and he joins us now in studio. He's a Libertarian candidate for Secretary of State this fall. We invited the WBA to join the conversation, but they declined. Andy, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, how do you think the experience changes for viewers when they only see two candidates debate on TV?
I think there's a lot of evidence from other states that a two-candidate debate receives lower interest. People don't want to turn in to hear the same old talk scripted talking points, you know, flown past each other that we get from the Republicans and Democrats when they appear on stage together. So I think there's clear evidence if you look at when Ross Perot was included in the presidential debates and other debates that have included third-party candidates that, aside from affecting the final vote total, it has a real impact on public attention and the amount of coverage and the debate receives.
Now, in the past, the Libertarian Party has complained and said that these benchmarks that we just mentioned, this 10% polling, raising $250,000, those are the criteria necessary to take part in the debates, saying that those don't necessarily work for the Libertarian Party for various reasons. But this year, you're taking it to another level, saying that the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association is actually breaking state campaign laws. Can you explain that argument?
Absolutely. As an example, I use my campaign or Robert Burke's campaign. If one of us was to go to a major corporation like the WBA is, it's a group of corporate television and radio owners, and said, we want a 90-minute broadcast commercial aired on all the state's networks for free, and they gave it to us, we'd go to jail for that. That would be a felony. And yet the Republicans and Democrats get to do it, and because they do it together, that's somehow special and exempt. And our argument is that the state laws don't grant any special privileges to Republicans and Democrats just because they get together and do something together.
Now, this is the first year that the Libertarian Party has taken this line of attack to be included in the debates. Why this year and why this argument?
One of the things is that we can pursue it this year under state law. The Federal Election Commission has reviewed and is generally hostile to these claims. But at the state level, this argument has not been heard, and there's no clear precedent saying that debates are okay, just because they include any two candidates.
One of the concerns of the organizations involved, in this case, the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association Foundation, is that the debates could become overrun with candidates, and it would be hard to get a cohesive picture of what was going on for the listeners, for the viewers. In this case, there would be four candidates for governor in this debate, but let's say there were eight. Let's say there were 10. Is that reasonable then to say, you know what, there should be limits on it somewhere?
Well, I think it's worth pointing out that we've seen plenty of debates and presidential primaries that did include that many candidates, and whether or not that was successful is up for debate. I think one of the key point to be making is that the Libertarians represent the third largest political party. We're running 12 candidates. None of these other minor parties are running more than one or two this year. So if we don't meet the threshold, then no third party candidate ever could.
And let's take a look at one of the benchmarks that we were talking about. So to be included, you need 10% at the polls and $250,000. Now, the Libertarian Party has said that it's possible for a candidate to poll that high, but not to raise that much money. And then that's a sticking point for you. Why is that?
Right. Well, in 2002, I'm sure a lot of people remember Ed Thompson was the Libertarian candidate for governor. He ended up getting 10%. He won in a couple of counties outright. But he did that on a budget of $50,000. Historically, Libertarian candidates spend a dollar or two per vote in the presidential elections compared to $10 to $20 for the Republican and Democratic campaigns. So we spend our money more effectively, for one thing, and obviously we don't have the special interest. Now, I'll put it this way. Nobody's trying to bribe the libertarians.
So let's say those benchmarks were tweaked and it wasn't $250,000. Maybe it's $50,000. Would you be happy with that, or do you want everybody to be included in that tent?
I think there's a fundamental sense people are outraged by using money as a threshold at all. You know, you can have a polling threshold. It has to be a poll that includes the candidates' names, which is another issue in this process, is they're citing polls that don't present our name to the voters. But if you were to have a threshold, then it has to be within something that could be reasonable. I don't know that I'd go $50,000. But one issue is that Robert Burke is running a self-funded campaign. We've seen several candidates do that successfully, run a self-funded campaign. He's protesting the waste and corruption of political donations, so he's not accepting any. So what amount of money he could raise or couldn't raise is kind of irrelevant. Under this standard, Ross Perot, again, wouldn't have been able to participate because he didn't accept, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in contributions. He opened his own checkbook. Mm.
Well, we did ask the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association to join this conversation today. They declined, but they did send a statement. I'm going to read a little bit of it here. I'm going to throw some more of these numbers at us. Since 1990, I'm quoting, the WBAF has established criteria to determine which candidates will be invited to participate in the debate. The criterion for 2014 sets the benchmark for 10% voter support and that the campaign raises a minimum of $250,000. The WBAF believes that it has a role in helping to inform voters of the positions and issues of the candidates through the debates, but does not have an obligation to promote or elevate a candidate in the election. Now, it's the last part of that that you're in particular taking issue with now. What do you say to that?
Well, I think the contradiction in that is fairly obvious. They say the purpose of the debate is to inform the electorate, and that participating in the debate doesn't amount to promoting a candidate, but including us would be promoting us. So they're applying a double standard. If the purpose is to inform the voters and let them know what the candidates stand for, then saying, well, not enough people have heard of this guy is a chicken and egg, you know, catch 22 kind of scenario.
Well, the WBA is nonpartisan. Why do you think they refuse to include the Libertarian Party?
Well, this is a nonpartisan organization that recently successfully spent, I forget the exact number, over 700 registered lobbying hours to get a bill passed which successfully exempted radio and television broadcasters from special sales taxes. That was worth millions of dollars, and they, you know, I think that's just one example that they have a cozy relationship with both the Republicans and Democrats. The parties seek to obviously engender a close relationship with the media, and so they don't want to upset the apple cart when it's time for them to, you know, get an interview or want to have one of their sitting politicians participate in WBA and WBA member stations, the television stations and radio stations, the programming.
Now, looking at the election this year, most analysts would tell you that Robert Burke doesn't have a chance of winning this fall, and a candidate from the Libertarian Party has never come close to winning a gubernatorial election in Wisconsin. So knowing that context and that history, what's at stake for you in this complaint?
Well, that's what they said in 1998 in Minnesota, and Jesse Ventura won that year. They excluded him from the debates, and he went around the state mocking them for it and ultimately won. And no Reform Party candidate had won before. That was the ticket he's running on. Wisconsin has voted third party before. You know, if you look through history, in 1924, we were the only state to give our presidential votes to a third party candidate, fighting Bob La Follette when he ran as the Progressive Party candidate. So I don't think it's true that a third party candidate can't win, but it becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy when the media says this candidate can't win, therefore we're not going to cover them.
Would inclusion in these debates make the difference?
Oh, absolutely. I'll tell you, Robert Burke's a great guy. He's a former insurance wholesaler. He's got a great public stage presence. And I have no doubt that when it comes to the issues, he would wipe the floor with Scott Walker and Mary Burke.
We're talking right now to Andy Craig, a member of Wisconsin's Libertarian Party. He filed a complaint on behalf of the state's Libertarian Party against the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association for excluding third-party candidates from their debates.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think the Libertarian Party or all third parties should be included in this fall's political debates? What do you think the role is for third parties in Wisconsin? Do you take them seriously? Should the media? Or do you think that debates would get too crowded, be a media circus of sorts? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're back with Andy Craig, who filed a complaint on behalf of the state's Libertarian Party against the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association for excluding third-party candidates from their debates, and he's also running for Secretary of State on the Libertarian ticket.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see in a debate? Just the two major parties? Anyone on the ballot or something in between? And if so, where do you draw the line? How do you set the standard? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're going to go to our callers now and take our first from Jürgen in Madison. Hello.
Hello.
What do you think?
Well, I think we should include all third parties.
Okay. And why is that?
Because I think none of the bigger parties think they can claim to have all the answers.
Okay, well, thank you for that call, and I think what you're getting at there is more voices, more opinions, and maybe more for the electorate to chew on. What do you think?
Well, I think it's absolutely true that in the Libertarian Party, we bring a message that is popular but is not being offered by either the Republicans and Democrats, and that's a mixture of small government fiscal conservatism as well as liberalism on social issues. You know, the Democrats are not in favor of free market economics, is one way to put it. And whereas the Republicans are irascibly authoritarian when it comes to social issues. As somebody who, for example, wants to see the state income tax repealed, but also wants my legal Iowa same-sex marriage to be recognized, I'm not going to have a home in either of the major parties. And there's a lot of voters in that situation.
Have you gotten a sense so far about how Wisconsinites feel about this issue?
Everybody I've talked to has been outraged and said we should be included. I have not met a single person who's yet said, well, no, all we want to hear from is Walker and Mary Burke. Everybody already knows what they're going to say, to be blunt. Nobody is expecting any surprise. It's not a debate at that point. It's a alternating press conference.
Okay, well, thank you for that call, Jürgen. And we go now to Joy in Eagle. Hi, Joy.
Hi there. I normally vote for one of the two major party candidates, but I really think it's disingenuous for any of us to try to stifle an open debate. And I do agree with your guest that we should have, you know, legitimate third party candidates have an opportunity to debate. I think it makes the candidates in the two major parties have to sharpen their knowledge, and I think what he just said is you get tired of hearing the sound bites, although, you know, I probably would never vote for a Libertarian candidate, but I would really welcome learning more about that, and I think the debates are the place to do it.
All right. Well, thank you for that opinion, Joy, and Joy saying, interesting point there that having other voices could sharpen the talking points of everybody.
Well, absolutely. That's obviously the point of any campaign is to win, and we want to win. But part of the point of running a third-party campaign in a two-party system is to be competitive for the marginal independent swing votes that decide an election. Those are who the Republicans and Democrats are worried about winning. And if there's a Libertarian message out there that they could lose those voters to, they'll come more in our direction. The Democrats on social issues, the Republicans on fiscal issues, and they will try to appeal to that third voice the same way the major parties reform themselves to appeal to Ross Perot voters.
Now, we live in the age of new media, and there's so much attention placed there in our society today. Is this worth your time and attention, focusing on TV and radio, when there's all these other avenues the Libertarian Party or any third party anyone could be pursuing instead?
Well, we absolutely are. We are pursuing all those methods. We have a very active presence on social media, Facebook, Twitter, all that stuff. We have an online presence. We reach out to people. We hold local monthly events and that sort of thing. We go to county fairs and state fairs and other summer fest, other events and campaign, go out and meet the voters. So it's, in fact, that's actually what the WBA said when they cut their financial threshold from $500,000 to $250,000. The official reason they did it is because, well, with modern, you know, social media technology, it's easier to run a campaign, but you don't need $250,000 to post a page on Facebook.
Okay, well, let's go back to the phones. Wesley joins us now. Wesley's in Fall Creek. Hey, Wesley.
Howdy. I just want to say I'm an independent. I vote for both parties. I look at the individual candidates and their values. And I think that the duopoly, the power of Team Red versus Team Blue, Team R versus Team D, it's a poison that's hurting the country. I think we need to get all the voices out there and make sure that everybody's heard. And I don't want to support tribalism where we're fighting against each other. We should be working with each other to try to build solutions.
Okay, thanks for that thought, Wesley. And, you know, we've got this binary system for the most part here. Do you think that it's an entrenched part of our system that Americans are willing to part with at this point in history?
Well, so I think it takes a major effort and a major dysfunction to overcome the binary two-party system, but it's happened before. The last time Americans elected a third-party candidate president, he freed the slaves. So it does happen, and it can happen. But as far as what he said, tribalism, I love that he used the term Team Red and Team Blue. That's something we're really fond of, because Republican and Democratic are words that actually mean something, and that has nothing to do with what these two parties represent and their, you know, respectively conservative or progressive agendas.
Okay. And have you gotten a response from the Government Accountability Board so far? You have a sense where this is at?
I have spoken to them. They've confirmed I've received the complaint. Their hands are tied by state laws that make these investigations private. It's basically like a grand jury proceeding. Once they've made a decision, which could happen at their meeting here at the end of August when they have that, we could then possibly appeal through the courts if we, you know, secure representation and that sort of thing. We could even continue this after the election. And that's what Gary Johnson, our presidential candidate, has been doing through his group, Our America Initiative, which I also lead here in Wisconsin, is they're suing the Commission on Presidential Debates over basically the same thing at that level.
Got a couple comments here on Facebook. Joe has said, I'm going to vote for him because of this protest vote. It's my vote to spend how I want. And Andy's saying, what are the Democrats and Republicans afraid of? Don't they think they can, quote, hold up to other ideas? I'm not a libertarian, but let them speak. So a couple of people there who are hearing your message. And we go back to the phones. Jason in Oak Creek. Hi, Jason.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
My comment or question is, you know, there's a hurdle here where voters may really want to vote for a third party, you know, privately. And how do you get past that hurdle where the voter, you know, they want to vote for Libertarian or Green Party or whoever, but they pretty much know that they're not going to win, so they kind of go for the candidate, Democrat or Republican.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you for that, Jason. And is this a case of, you know, maybe the people wanting to make sure that their votes count to go to our candidate, so it's not a protest vote, that it's a vote for somebody who's got a shot at the office?
Well, I absolutely understand the wasted vote argument, and that's something that we have to deal with the election system we have now. That's why one of the things I'm advocating in my campaign is that we have a system of instant runoff voting or ranked choice preference, where instead of going into the ballot box and checking one name, you get to go 1, 2, 3, 4, however many candidates there are, and rank them in order. It would get rid of primary elections altogether. The voters would go to their ballot on a single day, and they would be able to accurately express their opinion and their preferences without this having to go for the lesser of two evils thinking.
Now, if your challenge is successful, what do you see debates looking like in, you know, a couple of years?
I think it'll be pretty much the same, except there'll be a Libertarian on the stage.
Just a third. You don't see a fourth and a fifth.
Could see other third parties. The other candidate running a third party that campaigned is basically running as what we call a true independent. He's created the People's Party label, but I mean, without being rude to him, that's not a real party. The Green Party and the Constitution Party are generally the other two major third parties. And if they had candidates, we'd welcome them on stage. I don't think it would be an issue. Down in Arkansas and in Florida and in other states, there have been debates already this year for Congress and governor where the Republicans and Democrats did come and meet the other third party candidates on the stage.
Now, the Wisconsin Broadcasting Association, not the only organization that hosts debates. Wisconsin Public Radio, Wisconsin Public Television, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel also broadcast similar debates. Would you file complaints against these groups?
If they proceed in a similar manner, yes, we will. The thing is, the WBA is the biggest one, and the one that we know happens every year. So we went for them, you know, talked to them first. We're hoping that seeing this, some of the other debate sponsors will change their mind about the policies they're looking at. But I have said, and I believe that if other corporate-sponsored broadcast advocating the Republicans and Democratic candidates don't let the Libertarians participate, that that's an illegal violation, and we'll pursue it.
Andy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Libertarian Party member Andy Craig. He filed a complaint against the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association for excluding third-party candidates from their debates. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we meet legendary Wisconsin actor Alfred Lunt.
First, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency announced this week that it's going to impose its own rules on Wisconsin if the state's Department of Natural Resources doesn't submit regulations on fine air pollution within the next 2 years.
The state DNR has missed the submission deadline by over 2 years. They were supposed to have the new regulations in place by June 2012. The kind of pollution under consideration is linked to diseases like asthma and bronchitis.
George Meyer joins us now. He's the executive director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation and former secretary of the state's DNR. George, welcome to Central Time.
I'm glad to be on the show.
Well, the Environmental Protection Agency has issued a finding of failure to Wisconsin when it comes to limiting fine particle pollution. How significant is this?
Well, this is very, very unusual. In fact, it may be very unprecedented in terms of the Department of Natural Resources, many programs that are based on federal law. And the fact that this was not undertaken within the deadline is, and thereby EPA stating that it's going to issue its own rules, is very significant. And actually shows that priorities are not being followed at DNR to protect the environment.
Has Wisconsin ever gotten a warning like this before?
Not of this nature at all. And, in fact, that's what is as concerning about this as the issue that's involved, which is a public health issue. But the fact that the department did not adopt rules as they were required to by federal law within the time frame. They were asked to do this back in 2010. The deadline was in 2012. And they're just, you know, in 2014, the EPA said, that's enough. We're going to adopt rules within 2 more years.
Can you break this down a little for us? What exactly was Wisconsin supposed to provide rules for, and what did it fail in doing?
Okay, the specific rule in case is an air pollution rule, and it deals with what it's called major sources, which are the larger emitting facilities in the state. Things like power plants is an example. It's probably the best example. And this particular standard is for what's called fine particulates or soot, and it's the small – this – particular regulation deals with the more fine, the smaller pieces of material, particulates. But in fact, these are the most serious in terms of health. These get deep into your lungs, and it's associated. The reason the regulations are in place are for asthma, emphysema, this type of thing. And the standards are to be put in place so that when DNR issues its permits to these facilities, those power plants, as an example, would have to put on treatment to prevent this from getting into the air and into the neighborhoods where these facilities are. So this isn't just a paper kind of problem. There is a health concern associated by not going forward with these standards in a timely manner.
So the state was supposed to have submitted plans addressing these fine particles to the EPA back in June of 2012. Do you know what held things up?
Well, you know, according to that, they were waiting for some other federal lawsuit to be done so they could, not involving the department, but they wanted to see how that went or whatever. and I think other people have commented on this, what they should have clearly gone forward and carried out their responsibility. The lawsuit did not involve the state of Wisconsin. There was a deadline. Other states met the deadline. I think, you know, maybe a couple other states in the whole country didn't. But Wisconsin decided not to go forward at that time.
Now, as I understand it, the DNR is also saying they've had staffing shortages. They were waiting for the resolution of these lawsuits. Does that rationale, does that explanation hold up for you?
Well, they go forward with other rules and other work. Waiting for the lawsuit, I don't think was a very appropriate reason. And if they were even close to having the rule in place, you know, let's say they couldn't start it immediately, if they had shown tremendous progress, I suspect EPA would not have done what they've done. But obviously, it's 2 years past the deadline. I mean, this requirement went in effect in they were asked to do this starting in 2010, and they're just starting the rulemaking process in 2014. So, I mean, you can have staff shortages, but eventually you need, especially when it comes to a public health regulation, you need to be doing these things quicker. And, you know, EPA made that decision also, that they, in fact, filed this notice that they're going to adopt rules.
Now, you're a former secretary of the DNR. Do you see changes in how the department's being run, especially when it comes to emissions?
There clearly is a reduction in the, as an example, in the amount of enforcement and in inspections of facilities, which are very important. I mean, you can have all the best regulations in the world, but if you're not having timely inspections to see if facilities comply or enforcement. In fact, there was just a case, a water pollution case in, I believe it was Wood County or Marathon County, where 600,000 gallons of manure was discharged over a period of a year. And no inspection was done, and they wasn't caught. The facility didn't look for it. DNR didn't look for it, and it ended up getting a wetland into one of our rivers and went into the headwaters of a flowage, which is highly eutrophic because of too much nutrients. Now, those types of things need to be caught, and even when caught, there was a very small fine, $460 or something. There just seems to be more emphasis in getting the permits out the door rather than enforcing and inspecting and getting the, now for this situation, getting the standards into effect.
How serious is the issue of putting caps on small particle pollution here in Wisconsin particularly?
Well, these deal with the major power plants in the state, which are the larger emitters of pollutants. And as I mentioned, these small micron, it's the technical standard is the particles that are smaller than 2.5 microns, are significant health hazards. This is the dust that gets into your lungs. And because it's small, it can get deep into the lungs. So this is not an insignificant standard.
Now, a spokesperson for the DNR said that this small particle rule that is missing from Wisconsin is only a small part of Wisconsin's plan for the Clean Air Act and that everything else has been accounted for. So given that context, do you still see this as something that's significant, or is this maybe understandable when you're looking at a big thing like the Clean Air Act?
Well, there are other standards, but, you know, going back over the years since the Clean Air Act was passed, you know, this is highly unusual, if not unprecedented, that Wisconsin didn't comply with the law. It just shows a more lax system than there used to be. That this should have been a priority, especially because of the health concerns.
Do you think that the EPA will actually have to get involved here and impose its own rules, or do you think the DNR will get it together and get these rules out to them in a timely fashion?
Well, both the EPA and Wisconsin probably will start the rulemaking process. And now, I, you know, I it's indicated DNR is now going to start, but if they don't complete it within 2 years, EPA has to have their regulation in place within 2 years. So then 2 years, there will be a regulation, whether it's federal or state. But clearly, now we have two different agencies having to go through this process.
And do you expect that these new rules, whether they come from the EPA or from the DNR, do you expect them to be stricter than the ones that we have now?
I do, yes.
Well, George, we leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good to talk to you. Take care.
That was George Meyer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation and former Secretary of the Wisconsin DNR. The U.S. EPA announced this week that it is going to impose its own rules on Wisconsin if the state's DNR doesn't take action on fine particle air pollution in the next 2 years.
In this edition of Curious Wisconsin, we take a look at a Wisconsin legend of the theater, Alfred Lunt, born this week in 1892.
Director and critic Harold Clurman said of Lunt that he was, quote, universally acclaimed the finest American actor in the generation which followed John Barrymore. He was talking about Milwaukee-born Alfred Lunt, who, with his wife Lynn Fontanne, were a major force in American theater for 40 years. We'll find out about Alfred Lunt from Randy Bryant, president and CEO of the Ten Chimneys Foundation in Genesee Depot. Randy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Well,
Randy, give us the basics. Who were Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontanne?
Well, Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontanne, they were the premier stage actors from the 1920s through the 1960s, and they were perfectionists at his best.
And how did Wisconsin shape Alfred Lunt as a person, as an actor?
Well, Alfred was born and raised in Wisconsin, and his father died at an early age, so he really became the man of the house, taking care of things, highly devoted to his mother, Hattie. But when you think of how Wisconsin shaped him, he went to Carroll College, and it was there at Carroll College that he was encouraged to go off to Boston and to stay in theater.
And you said they were perfectionists. How did that come into play in their theater career?
Oh, they were relentless. They loved playing in front of an audience, and so therefore they made sure that it was done perfect before they actually got on stage.
And they were on Broadway, their big claim to fame?
They were on Broadway, but they played all over the country, and that's really what attributes to their success, the fact that they played everywhere. And so they felt that everyone deserved to have quality, good theater. And so they played in the smallest places. They played in even churches. But they made sure that they continued to act and continued to deliver quality theater throughout the country.
You mentioned they loved being up in front of a live audience. I understand that while they were in some films, that wasn't their priority. Why did they go for the theater more than the screen?
Well, again, being perfectionists, and they really want to have the artistic control. Hmm. And so back in those days, it was not heard of to provide artistic control. Today, you see some actors get that, but it was unheard of back then. But the other thing is that they really love responding to a live audience and the response they receive from a live audience. And so they didn't like just doing a take and then taking and having someone else decide, okay, it's done. Hmm. They felt that it's done when we say it's done.
What roles do we know them best for today?
Well, in Design for Living, you know them in, I know this one by heart. In Design for Living, they played Gilda and Otto. And then in The Taming of the Shrew, it was Kate and Petruchio.
Uh-huh.
But their one and single and only film was The Guardsman. Started out as a play that they did in 1924, and then it was done for MGM in 1931. And so that's their one and only movie that they did together.
And their national reputation in the theater world, were they regarded as top-flight performers?
They were the best. As I stated earlier, they were the premier actors, and they developed the method acting that you see today.
Really?
Never before did actors turn their back on an audience. That was never thought of. And Alfred turned his back on the audience, and they had actual conversations. They spoke over one another, which is the way people speak naturally, but back in those days, you would say your line, then you wait, and then the other person would respond, and that was not natural for them. The other reason why they really gained attraction by the audience is that being married, they were able to do a little bit more than your average stage actors could do. So, and they took it to the limits.
Didn't I read that they were in something a little risque that involved a menage a trois? Speaking of.
Well, it may have been called a menage a trois back then. I think today we would have trouble seeing what's wrong with it. But, yeah, it was. But actually, the menage a trois made it quite popular. I mean, it's the ticket prices were going for way over list price. And it sold out for every performance. And basically it stopped after 6 months because Noel Coward got tired. He just didn't want to continue on. But it could have gone on forever because there were crowds and crowds of people that were there. And they even had to have the police control some of the crowds at times.
Were they always performing together or did they do a lot of work on their own as well?
No. They made a contract. One of the reasons why they went with the theater guild was that they were able to agree that they would only act together and they would be able to have their summers off to be able to spend out at Ten Chimneys. Mm. And so there's an exception. In 1927, Lynn made a film, I think it was Strange Interludes, by Eugene O'Neill. But other than that, they acted together. And this started early on. If you consider that they met in 1919, married in 1922, and in 1924 is when they joined the theater guild, and that's when they made their pact. So that's why you don't see them separate.
Huh.
Sounds like quite a love story when you compare it to, you know, the Hollywood romances of today. They really seem to have been in love with each other. And they weren't just icons of theater, it sounds like. They were also known for having incredible elegance and grace, weren't they?
Incredible elegance and grace, but also just being incredible people. You know, when you look at their core values in terms of what they value lasting relationships. And they had many relationships with many people. And so, and when you think of the secrets that were kept, coming out to Ten Chimneys in Genesee Depot, first of all, you have to think Genesee Depot, little Genesee Depot. And then you think of the big stars that were out there. So Laurence Olivier, Katharine Hepburn, who else? Trying to think of... I'm losing some of the thoughts there. I can see his face, Montgomery Clift. Mm. But all of them were coming out to Genesee Depot. And at that time, it was not known. But yet they would come out there and they would spend months at a time. Helen Hayes would spend months at a time out there. And they would enjoy themselves. Nothing was said by the town. The lunch did not broadcast, we have these people coming out or whatever. But their relationships lasted a lifetime, and we still have people coming to Ten Chimneys sharing stories about Alfred and Lynn and just how giving, how kind they were. And so what we emulate at Ten Chimneys is all a reflection of what their lives have been.
Well, take us to their home at Ten Chimneys. What's it like?
It is amazing. It is a place where one can go to escape. Ten Chimneys is really multifaceted because when you go there in the main house, it's like going into a set. It was designed, many of the murals there, many of the murals were designed by Claggett Wilson, who was a set designer. And but the house is very whimsical. It's a lot of fun. And it is a stage. And it's as if you're walking into stage. The studio where they practiced their lines and acted and where they would dance is a wonderful place. And then you have the cottage, which is Scandinavian as a result of Alfred's roots. Foremost, it's just a place to relax. The pool, one of the first pools one of the first in-ground pools in the state of Wisconsin, one of the largest pools. And then you have to remember, it was a gentleman's farm. And so a reflection of all of what Alfred and Lynn enjoyed. Alfred was a Cordon Bleu cook, and so he would take from his gardens. And Ten Chimneys, we're proud to say that we have continued that on. And so we give, with the vegetables that we raise, we give to the food pantries in both Waukesha and Milwaukee County. The eggs that we raise, we also pass those on. So it's really nice. We have the aroma of the farm there. But yet at the same time, we have the setting, which is so great, so elegant, and so exceptional, which we open once a year to the public. where they can come have all access to all the buildings and all the grounds. If you want to have a picnic there, come out and have a picnic at Ten Chimneys.
Well, speaking of a picnic, real quick in the next 20 seconds or so, if someone wants to visit, what do they do?
If you want to visit, just call in to our line, 262-968-4100, and you get the reservationist, make your reservation, and come on out to Ten Chimneys.
All right, Randy, thanks so much for coming to visit us today.
Thank you.
That's Randy Bryant. He is president and CEO of the Ten Chimneys Foundation.